If only I can get the promotion, then I'll have enough money to be happy. If only I could meet the right person, then I'll be somebody who's not such a jerk, right? That logic basically necessitates that we are always going to be less than we could be. And faithfulness invites us to say, hey, you're good. You're okay already.
You're listening to Good is in the Details. I'm Gwendolyn Dolsky.
And I'm Rudy Sallow.
And this is the podcast where we learn what we didn't know in the spirit of Socrates, all with the aim of living a good life, a knowledgeable life. In this episode, before we dive into the episode, I just have a couple of pod business updates. One thing, we've got some great reviews on Apple Podcasts. Thank you, listeners, for leaving those. Another thing is we've got another book for our book club on Patreon. So if you want to get extra content and support the pod, go to patreon.com. And there is an event we're sponsoring with the women's networking group, Modern Day Wife. We're sponsoring that event that's going to be in Beverly Hills, April 5th. Yours truly is going to be on one of the panels speaking about podcasting and business and all good things. If you have a business, if you're a woman entrepreneur, I highly recommend this event. It's going to be fantastic. And I will link ticket information in the show notes and a discount offer code. And Rudy, you and I are going to be at the next Outlier Podcast Festival in Irvine at the end of May. I'll also link that in the show notes. Anyone who's interested in starting a podcast, or if you have an indie pod, this is a great, great event to go to. And we will be talking about our journey in podcasting and giving some tips on how to succeed. Okay, business out of the way. What do you think, Rudy?
I think it's time to get started with our okay. discussion about camping. But it's not like real camping, but it's
a metaphor.
It's pretty similar. It's a metaphor for what exactly?
Well, this is something I love. My background is in existentialism. I am really drawn to this branch of philosophy called existentialism.
Which is what, Gwen? What is existentialism? Really? I mean, for the dummies out there like me.
In a nutshell, I would say existentialism came on the scene to challenge the idea that we are to follow order and rules in order to live a good life, that there was something missing in the history of philosophy that just aimed to talk about reason, and there was so much more to the human experience that didn't fit into a nice, tidy conclusion or argument, and thus came about existentialism. So that's it, broadly speaking. And our guest today is a philosopher, and he is the author of Camping with Kierkegaard. I love this type of work because our guest does do academic philosophy, but this book is for the general public. He is using philosophy to give us an idea of how to live well. And our guest is Professor Aaron Simmons. He was also a guest on our favorite indie pod, Seize the Moment podcast. So shout out to Alan and Leon. But this episode I really loved because Aaron is focusing on letting go of all of the checkbox of life, this idea that if you just follow all of the rules or thinking what you're supposed to be doing, and then you achieve them, there's still going to be something missing. Like, take some time to connect with yourself, with your relationships, with nature. Enjoy your life. Enjoy the journey and don't get hung up on all the external validation and all the social media and all that stuff that can really govern our lives, but it's not going to lead to a fulfilling life.
Should I talk now about how we started off the episode with a punk rock challenge? Or do you think that's not really appropriate at this particular time?
That's perfect, Rudy.
No, I really enjoyed this episode, and I got to admit, I listened to several episodes that our guest was on, and he and I seemed to think of things along the same lines about achievement and goals and how to accomplish goals, how to view your goals, how to not make your life into a checklist, to try to identify what's important and how to do it with a philosophical approach. So I enjoyed this. This was truly a conversation. And there were a few times where I challenged our guest, and he did a great job answering my challenges. And it was a really enlightening conversation.
Okay, let's talk some existentialism, a bit of outdoorsy stuff with Aaron Simmons.
And so did a episode or a post or whatever a few weeks ago on MXPX and their punk sensibilities.
Ooh, Rudy, what do you have to say about that?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I definitely remember MXPX from back in the days, back in the 90s, but I was never a fan of theirs.
I doubt your judgment. All your questions will be suspect now.
It's good. I should be doubted. I'm way more of an old school, 70s, 80s guy. I mean, I got into the punk movement in the 90s. I was in a bunch of bands during the third wave. And I got to say, like, during the third wave, I guess I wasn't a huge fan of the bands that came out of the third wave. There was several bands that I was a fan with. I guess I'm just too old school. I'm too nostalgic, Aaron. I look to the past too much, not to the present. That's my problem.
Well, talking to philosophers who think that citing 18th century thinkers is the best way to live, you are not alone. But I, for what it's worth, what got me thinking about MXPX again, so I grew up listening to them way, way, way back. And then I was more of a kind of extreme metal fan and never was super into punk. So I liked the hardcore scene more than the kind of pop punk stuff. But they have a new album that just came out a couple months ago, and it's really freaking good. And so that got me thinking about them, and I was kind of rediscovered their discography. And I'm sure if you're a 70s, 80s punk fan, like, you also won't want to check out the post I did on cattle decapitation. That was, I thought, especially fun about thinking environmentally and changing our moral compass. Today was about Billy Joel and his new album and what it means not to speak for 30 years. So some fun stuff, you know.
Yeah, not a big fan of chopping cows' heads off, even though I am a meat eater, although I try to limit things. And I've never really been a big Billy Joel guy, but you sound very interesting, and I love your stuff, and I've been listening to it and reading it.
Thanks, man.
And I think you and I actually see eye to eye on a lot of things.
Well, I appreciate it. I was a session drummer, for what it's worth, for 20 years maybe.
Oh,
and
my gosh.
Got out of that basically when I was finishing grad school and starting the career in philosophy, and have now returned to it quite a bit, living vicariously through my son, who's 14 and a really fantastic drummer. And so he's like, oh, well, yes, I definitely need to go buy that amazing new maple snare because Atticus can use it, when in fact it's just the one I always wanted. So there's a lot of that going on now.
That's really awesome.
Sorry, Gwendolyn, we've sidestepped. I apologize.
Hey, that is okay. So Rudy, Aaron is also friends with Drew Dalton. We did a sidestep talking about music and punk rock in between talking about evil.
That's true.
We're philosophers. We're all about the sidestep. I mean, that's
with
how we
any
get
of it.
We don't get to the point. What's the fun in that? There has to be like all sorts of sidetracks
all
and examples.
All about faithfulness, not success. That's right. See, look at this. Internalizing all the messages.
When you're discussing faithfulness, I just want to give our audience an idea of what is Kierkegaard's notion of faithfulness, because people will hear the word faith and they'll have different ideas. So what is it in the sense that you're using it?
In the new book, Camping with Kierkegaard, I talk about faithfulness as a way of life. I should make very clear that this book is not meant to be an introduction to the Danish philosopher Kierkegaard, nor is it even really meant to be an introduction to philosophy. It's more using philosophy as a kind of archive upon which we can draw for thinking well in order to live better. For Kierkegaard, 19th century Danish philosopher who is often referred to as the father of existentialism, he understood faith as a highest passion for one's lived experience. So faith for Kierkegaard was cashed out determinately in a religious direction. He was himself a Christian in a Lutheran vein, but he also understood, as this kind of existential thinker, that faith was a precise kind of risking oneself. And in that sense, that's what I try to pick up on, right? So I, in this book, am not trying to cash out faith or faithfulness as a religious idea, but instead simply understanding it as risk with a particular direction. And so given that we are all defined by vulnerability, we're going to die, and defined by relationality, we don't exist on our own. We've got to figure out how to make the most of time, given that we don't have an unlimited amount of it. And for me, that's where the hard work of living faithfully comes in. So what risks are worth taking with our lives, our actions, our beliefs, our behaviors, in what direction are we hoping to throw our existence? Who are we hoping to become? And so when I talk about faithfulness, it's that idea. It's trying to invite people to think about who are you becoming and are you okay with yourself? And if not, let's change things up. Let's try to be more intentional about who we're becoming so that the risk we take every single day, given that we don't have an infinite amount of time to correct things, probably should be something with a directedness that is worthy, I say, of our finitude, of our frailty. And so I draw on Kierkegaard, but it's not meant to be a kind of explanation of his view. I've written those books. They're unreadable academic tomes. But this one is instead trying to kind of appropriate these existential insights to try to get us away from this cultural norm where only achievement matters. All that makes a difference is, you know, how much money, how many successes, how many goals have you set and pulled off? And I'm trying to invite people to rethink that by leaning into this Kierkegaardian existential notion of risk with direction.
Mm-hmm. It's really perfect. I love the way in which, like you said, like it's not an academic text. It's really using these philosophical ideas for everybody to essentially reconnect with the things that make us human. You know, like even the notion of camping or being outdoors or the way in which we interact with our friends, our family, or the way in which we view ourselves, that seems to be, I think we're at a loss for that right now because so much of our time is consumed with concern with what's happening everywhere else or what other people are doing or what other people are thinking. And then there is this loss of, wait a minute, how do I enjoy my life? What do I want out of my life? How am I defining it? And something that really hit me was I like to use Aristotle's notion of you are what you do, you are your habits. But it's kind of rephrased in your work, we are who we are becoming. Could you maybe unpack what does that mean? We are who we are becoming.
Yeah, so this is drawn again from a variety of different sources. I care less that people can cite their sources in this case and more that they are thinking deeply about how they're living. And so hopefully by giving them some vocabulary and some tools to kind of fill out their toolbox, it maybe allows them to make better sense of what they're already doing and why they do it. Aristotle, you're right, says that our identity is formed by and grounded in our habits, what we've made normal is the way I like to put that, what we've allowed to be normative. And St. Augustine says something similar when he says that what we desire determines who we are. So our desires, our habits, our actions, this is constitutive of selfhood. Who we are is not some stable thing, like when we tell our friend going on a first date, hey, just go be yourself, it'll all work out. The existential tradition basically says, there is no self back there. The self that you are is the self that you daily live into. And so that's what I'm trying to develop and reminding people who you decide to be today will be determinative of who you will be 5 years, 10 years, 50 years from now. And so I tell my students a lot, they don't get to lean too hard into the, oh, I'm just 19, I'll make smarter choices when I'm older. It's like, well, no, because if you make stupid choices now, you'll be the person who has made stupid choices normative for them. And it's unlikely that you're going to just wake up one day into wisdom. Wisdom has to be cultivated. Aristotle says that it's hard work to be excellent. And that's where, for me, the idea of faithfulness as a way of life, not just a one-time thing, this is drawn from Kierkegaard, where he says that the Greeks knew what it meant to understand faith as a task for a lifetime, because it's a lived thing. You embody this, you put it into practice. Ultimately, you know, we can choose otherwise is, I think, a pretty good mantra for making sense of where we are. Are you miserable? You can do differently. Doesn't mean that you can change your job or radically overhaul your career immediately. Doesn't mean that you can immediately change all your relationships. But it does mean that, like, maybe you can stay in your car for 30 seconds longer to let that awesome song finish before getting out and going into the office. Or maybe you can, in fact, change the playlist. Life is too short to listen to pop music. Like, we can do little tiny things that do create and cultivate real habits that make joy possible amidst a world where despair is so tempting.
I think something else that you wrote in here that really struck me. Well, actually, I like a lot in your book. There are a lot of gems in here.
I appreciate it.
Quote, "We struggle with self-confidence precisely because we have allowed arrogance to become culturally normative." So I love the way you kind of flip the script on there, this idea of fake it till you make it or whatnot, or this way in which you're supposed to be an expert or just do a quick Google search, like don't ever let anybody know of any of your vulnerabilities, anything like that. And that's actually what takes away from self-confidence is the idea to pretend that you do know everything. This is probably why I like Socrates so much. In fact, I'm seeing a lot of Socrates here. I know you're focusing on Kierkegaard, but even this idea of being a self requires a deep connection with others. And I love that as well, because that feels like it's flipping the script. It's not retreating from society. It is actually engaging the relationships when you figure out who you are. And that's one of the things I like about Socrates is this idea of understanding the meaning of the oracle and wisdom did not require a retreat, but it required an engagement with others for him to discover the truth of what the oracle meant. And then for to come to a conclusion that it was a calling for him to engage in dialogue with others.
Yeah.
Can you explore, can you tell me a little bit more about this self-confidence precisely because we have allowed arrogance to become culturally normative? What is your, what do you mean by that? I love it, but I want to know.
Well, I appreciate that. So it is Socrates I'm thinking of when I say somewhere else in the book that true self-confidence is ultimately grounded in genuine humility. And this is a Socratic idea that if we're going to actually be confident about where we stand, we have to have been honest with ourselves about the fact that there were other options for where I could stand. And that's a humbling experience that I am here on purpose. Again, that's the direction I've chosen, worthy of my finitude, worthy of my risk. But it's not the only option, hence the risk. I mean, Derrida, Jacques Derrida says at one point that there is no decision except in the face of the undecidable, which is an unbelievably technical and unhelpful way of saying something really awesome, which is no one has to think about whether to go get ice cream or go have a liver transplant, right? Like, no, the ice cream is what we take. There is no Sophie's choice in that. Mm-hmm. The question becomes, which of these two colleges do I go to? Do I take this job or that job? What is it that I will do today, as Sartre says, stay and help my mother or go off and defend my country? It's only when we really recognize there are other ways forward that are also moral, also sensible, also reasonable, that we have the risk of choosing. But it's in that moment that we now are confident enough to say, because I'm humble enough to realize I could do differently, I'm doing what I'm doing on purpose. I could be wrong, but I'm doing this reflectively with intentionality. I'll give you two examples of what this looks like in practice. So my son, he's 14 and recently was auditioning for all county percussion, then all region, then all state, and you know, super proud of him. He made all of them. He's fourth or fifth or something in the state of South Carolina now as an eighth grade percussionist. But what was so cool is as we'd go to these auditions, you know, like I was a drummer forever. And so I understand the idea of pumping yourself up and getting excited and getting in the right headspace. But the song that we would play to get him ready to go do this work was Kendrick Lamar's Humble, right? Sit down, be humble. The whole idea was not, you're the greatest, you're the best, you got this, rah. It was, no, man, like, sit down, be humble, rest into the fact that you've put in the practice. Be confident because your humility means you've got sticks in your back pocket and you know how to use them. You don't need swagger. You can actually just be good. For me, that idea is what then sets up in this broader cultural sense a real resistance, or as you say, flipping the script, or as Lamar might put it, right, pimping the butterfly. Like what we're trying to do is say the assholes of the world don't get to dictate the behavior for the rest of us. We can actually make them irrelevant by fostering a commitment to humility, virtue, kindness, as the kinds of characteristics that facilitate lives not constantly defined by the fear that someone's going to be better than me. As I tell people all the time, if I am the best in a room, I need to change rooms. My goal is to be in the room with the best. I want to be surrounded by people who also love goodness, truth, and beauty, and then push each other to love it even more. but not push each other to love it more so that we can outpace those guys. It's not competitive, right? That's why I talk about camping. This is just a metaphor. People may not like camping. This book is still for them. It's an attempt to say, where is it we go where competition falls away and excellence becomes a priority, such that joy is now with us on the trail, instead of only possible when we get to the top of the mountain. That's the task. We can maybe do better at that as a society if we start thinking a little bit more philosophically and then allow, we might say, virtue to underwrite our business practices rather than letting our business practices and success and market value dictate what gets counted as a virtue.
Yes. You know, it was kind of a deal breaker for me when I was in a relationship with somebody I live close in Pasadena to the Rose Bowl, and there's this 5K track, and it's outdoors, and you've got like the beautiful San Gabriel Mountains, and I love to just go and jog it, and the people there of all shapes and sizes, different ages, you've got moms with their coffee, you've got professional runners, you've got elderly dog walkers, and I love being in that space, and I would time myself, and I was frustrated because I wanted to shave off a bit of time on my 5K, and the person I was with was like, why?
Yep.
There was I didn't have an answer for it other than I loved being in this space and I wanted to excel and I wanted to challenge myself. Mm-hmm. But was it going to make me more money? Was it going to make me the fastest woman out there? No, it was for myself. And it was such a deal breaker because the person could not understand. Well, that was my red flag, I guess. That was one of the red flags. Yep. But we've lost that sense of just personal achievement for its own sake.
This episode is sponsored by Factor. What could Factor actually be? Well, let me tell you, Factor is a great way to eat healthy and take charge of your health and what you put into your body. Basically, eating better is easy with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never frozen meal, so don't put these into the freezer. These are chef crafted, dietitian approved, and ready to go in just 2 minutes. You'll have over 35 different options to choose from every week, including Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. I did the Keto. I could go on and on about all the delicious meals that I had had. All six of the ones that I ate were filling and left me energized and ready to work out and go throughout my day. Also, there are more than 60 add-ons to help you stay fueled up and feeling good all day long. Honestly, what are you waiting for? Get started today and get after your goals. There are two-minute meals. Fuel up fast with Factor's restaurant-quality meals that are ready to heat and eat wherever you are. Pancakes, smoothies, and more. Discover a wide variety of easy options for the entire day, like breakfast, midday bites, and more. No prep. No mess meals. Factor meals are ready to heat and eat. There's no prepping, cooking, or cleanup needed. Flexible. Today is all about flexibility. We're working from home. We're working from here. We're working from there. It fits to your schedule. Get as much or as little as you need by choosing your meals every single week. Plus, you can pause or reschedule your deliveries at any time. Factor is the perfect solution if you're looking for fast, premium options with no cooking required. Thank God, because I am such a bad cook, I could burn cereal. That's right, I could burn cereal, but not Factor. Factor is the perfect solution for fast, premium options with no cooking required. Sign up and save. We've done the math. Factor is less expensive than takeout, and every meal is dietitian approved to be nutritious and delicious. Head to factormeals.com/details50. That's factormeals.com/details50 and use code details50 to get 50% off. That's code details50 at factormeals.com/details50 to get 50% off.
That's right. It's constant instrumentalism grounded in what I call a success logic, where only if it's able to yield the applause from what Kierkegaard calls the crowd, or Nietzsche calls the herd, only if they are excited about what I've done is what I've done worth doing. And I think that that is a recipe not only for personal misery, because notice, right, if success is the goal, the problem is you might actually achieve it, in which case then what do you do the next day? Right? How do you live after that? Because everything was driven toward achieving it. So you might actually be then defined by success, but you're also wrecked by failure. You know, when I was, I don't know, 18. I had three goals. I wanted the truck from Back to the Future because it's unreally cool. Like, my gosh, it's the best thing ever. That big Toyota black truck with the lights on top. And I wanted a wolf because, I mean, come on, driving that truck with a wolf sitting in the passenger seat, who could be cooler? And then I, you know, as 18, 19 year olds do, was thinking like, and I'd also love to end up spending my life with somebody that I am absolutely madly in love with. Well, I think it was 21. I bought a black Toyota Tacoma. Now, it took me 9 years to pay for the stupid thing, but I had the truck that I thought I wanted. I couldn't buy a wolf because it turns out liability insurance is kind of a beast. And so I got a Siberian Husky, which was close enough. And then went to Florida State, got a master's degree, and then ended up marrying my wife. We've been together 22, 23 years now. So at 24, I had checked all the boxes that I thought would determine happiness for me. The problem was I turned 25. And so what we do, right, and this is the way our culture works, is we just add new checkoff box categories. Oh, I want to go get a PhD. Well, I did that at 28. Oh, I want to get a tenure track job. Well, done at, you know, what, 34. Like, it ends up being that we live our life always trying to get somewhere or get something so that we can feel good enough in order to, like, be comfortable with who we are. This is what I term in the book a if only, then I'll logic. If only I can get to the weekend, then I'll have time to rest. If only I can get the promotion, then I'll have enough money to be happy. If only I could meet the right person, then I'll be somebody who's not such a jerk, right? That logic basically necessitates that we are always going to be less than we could be. And faithfulness invites us to say, hey, you're good. You're okay already. Circumstances might suck. And so let's think about that. Let's work on injustice. Let's overcome historical marginalization. Let's work really hard to make the world look differently in the future. But how can we do that if we have forgotten our own agency? If we've not lived into the very freedom that defines us as relational beings? And that's what I'm trying to invite people into by saying, hey, go to the mountains with me. But it might mean just go for a 5K in Pasadena, right? It doesn't mean literally go pick up a tent. It means find spaces that remind you why you get out of bed and why, in fact, it's worth getting a good night's sleep so that tomorrow you can do it again. And I think that that's something we've forgotten in a culture that says, how many followers do you have? You must be saying good things. Mm-hmm. My brother has told me repeatedly about my YouTube channel. He's like, dude, throw a cat off a roof. You'll immediately go viral, right? Because half the world will hate you and half the world will think it's hilarious. But instead, I keep trying to make little short philosophy videos. And those are much harder to get people to be excited about because we are in a world that Harry Frankfurt defines as a world covered up with bullshit. And it's because, as you said earlier, we feel like we've got to fake it till we make it. He claims when we live in a society where everybody has to have an opinion about stuff they don't understand, bullshit will eventually take over. And that's exactly what we see now in a world of quote unquote fake news and misinformation. It's a world where we've abandoned a concern for truth because we aren't even trying anymore. It's just, can I sell something to somebody? Can I get more likes? It's not about, yeah, but are you okay with who you are becoming? And that's what I'm trying to cultivate.
I don't mean to like speak for you, Rudy. It's just that this discussion reminds me so much about your experience with climbing Mount Whitney and your like just push for personal excellence and being outdoors.
Well, yeah, that's where I've really connected with, not in particular, we haven't gotten into the whole, what you were doing up in the North Carolina mountains, Aaron, and the trout fishing and everything. But I was starting to connect with what I had read and what I had heard you speak about. There is something about being out in nature and being, I hate to admit it, alone, that I connected to what you were talking about. I feel that when I am out there in nature, that's the best, and I'm at peace. Right. My mind is at peace most of the time. My mind is never like perfectly at peace, but I do feel that like that's when I'm at my optimal creative mode or zone. Mm-hmm. Like even though I'm walking for, you know, from point A to point B and I'm trying to be safe and I am trying to somewhat meet a certain time, my mind is at ease. And that's when the stories, or that's when I do figure out some personal answers to questions or do try to determine things. And I don't know, maybe that's just because we are, at the end of the day, animals. Humans are animals. Mm. We are of nature. Mm-hmm. And living in houses and driving in cars and having technology are things that are human made. And we really can't connect with ourselves when we're in these environments, but we can in nature. I don't know. I'm talking like granola crazy right now. I'm just trying to say, I'm just trying to say that I had the same reaction that you have had in my connection with nature. I do feel there is something very special about it. I don't go out in the nature very often. Maybe it's only like maybe 10 times a year, but 10 mm-hmm. times a year is enough for me to,
oh yeah,
to really move forward. And I didn't do that before the pandemic. And I know you've also talked about how the pandemic was this great reset, or it should have been this great reset, although we're all going back to work now and we're all going back to our prior lives. But there was something about the pandemic that made me reset my goals. There's just so much truth to everything that you're saying that I connect with about if you're just trying to live off of a checklist of achievement, is that really living? Once you check that box, do you actually feel happiness, or is it just like, well, what am I going to do next? And it's this if-then thinking that I'm trying to change. But I'm also, I got to ask you your opinion about this, Aaron. So something mm-hmm. that I do, and I've talked about this both at my law firm to other attorneys, as well as we actually had a segment on one of our recent episodes about when Gwen and I gave a talk at a podcast conference about how every single year towards the last 2 weeks of the year, I whip out my goal list for the year.
Mm-hmm.
And I see what I achieved and what I didn't achieve. And that helps me set forth my goals for 2024 or 2025 or 2026. So how do we balance having goals with living in the moment? Mm-hmm. Like, how do you, what's the advice that you give about, well, no, I'm not saying to throw everything to the wind and just live day by day, but just have some balance. And I think that's the best advice we could give to people about how to live life better.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the question. And so feel free, Rudy, buy a Subaru and come hang out with me in Asheville. we will welcome you with open arms.
So funny. My wife suggested that I bought a Subaru, and I said, absolutely hell no. I will not buy a Subaru. But that's a whole other side conversation.
Our granola is vegan. I actually live just south of Asheville in Greenville, South Carolina, but spend lots of time up there. And So I think you're asking the right question, which is, okay, you read Camping with Kierkegaard, you watch my YouTube videos on philosophy for where we find ourselves, you read my Substack at Philosophy in the Wild, you're in. You say, okay, this sounds great. But look, like, don't we still have to go to work on Monday? And don't we still have church or whatever on Sunday? And don't we have to take our kids to school on Thursday? None of the things that were the case change being the case once we have this kind of existential awakening. And I think that this is really, really powerful, because David Foster Wallace, in what I think is the single best book of philosophy ever written, it's a commencement address he gave called This Is Water. And in there, he says that adulthood is defined necessarily by day in, day out monotony. And what he recommends is not that we radically overhaul everything. We don't just have, you know, again, the mass migration away from jobs. We all move to the hills. What he says is we remind ourselves that things aren't obvious. Where we find ourselves is not necessary. There are other ways we could find ourselves. And so the fact that we're here is contingent. Possibility remains. So do the best we can to live into that possibility in the moment in front of us. And so for me, what that looks like is I want my students and my friends and the listeners to the podcast, I want them all to be successful. Don't get me wrong. I just don't want them to be defined by success as the ultimate value theory for their own identity. And the way I like to think about this is the goal list that you set at the end of the year, I see that as logistics. It's a matter of saying, hey, if I really want to do X or Y, I'm going to have to put in the work that makes X and Y possible for me. In other words, you are setting aside the right time, the right energy to make the self you hope to be a year from now come true. And so think about it in terms of selfhood and then see the achievements as logistics. So I have no problem, Gwen, if you want to shave off 10 seconds off your 5K, do it just because it's interesting to you to see if in fact that's something that is possible for you. When I mountain bike, which I do a lot, I'm always trying to see, man, like, did I personal record that downhill? Not because that's what gives me joy, right? But I'm just kind of interested logistically to see if, in fact, the work, the effort, the practice I'm putting into this, is it something that is cultivating my selfhood in a way that is actually able to progress and deepen into that direction? If I ride only one trail, that's fine, but it's also going to not open up excellence as a lived task. It's just going to make that repetitive activity something that I enjoy, which is fine, but it's not the only way to think about how we move forward. So my thought is not abandon success. Just think about it as logistics.
Where does posting on social media play into this whole thing? And I know you've kind of alluded to that a little bit throughout this discussion, but it's so interesting because I'm not a big social media poster. The vast majority of times when I do post, it is me out in nature doing a hike. Yeah. It might be some time. It might be some time of my hike or something like that.
Showing off your aloneness. I get you.
but you're right in a way that, in a sense, it is kind of showing off because I am sometimes I'm like documenting my time. I'm documenting my miles, and that's my. I've been using social media to document things to see if I'm getting better, to see if I'm getting faster, and then I started to feel bad. I was like, wait a minute, like people might be interpreting this that you're bragging, or people might be interpreting this that you're like shaming them because you're out here doing this and you know, or anything. That's a really negative mentality. I'm trying to think about how do we incorporate social media positively so by it doesn't come off that we're like bragging. One of the things that I find extremely annoying, and no offense to anybody that's out there, no offense to any listener, but people like posting like stuff at the gym and everything that they're doing at the gym or this exercise or that exercise. I don't know why that irritates me, but it really does and it shouldn't. But so I'm looking for some advice here.
So Rudy, send me an email and I'll send you back plenty of pictures of my quads and triceps, just so that you can be intimidated without the audience. No, I mean, look, I'm with you. In fact, just this morning, saw a friend of mine post a picture, you know, flexing in front of the mirror, taking a selfie at the gym. And again, I'm with you. It's not so much that like I'm offended. It just kind of bugs me in the sense of, so what is it we're doing here? And for what it's worth, I tend to think of this as a phenomenologist. And a phenomenologist, again, I'm sure you guys have talked a lot about this on the podcast, but for new folks, phenomenology just looks into the way we make sense of the world from a first personal experienced point of view. And so what is happening when we see all these people post pictures of themselves at the gym or their Strava ride or their King of the Mountain time or whatever it is? And I actually think that the phenomenon that's problematic is what we've already diagnosed. It's the idea that in order to feel okay about yourself, you need other people to applaud. That's deeply, deeply disturbing. And it's what the existential philosophers call bad faith, because it's you not living intentionally because you think it's worth your time and finitude. It's you living this way because you think other people will be jealous, right? That's fundamentally a bad model of selfhood. It's inauthentic, say some of the philosophers. On the other hand, the phenomenon of sharing with other people the things that we are doing and of which we have some, you know, semblance of pride, I actually think is deeply, deeply valuable. So here's why. A, I hate doing press for my work. Because what it ends up sounding like, I'm with you, Rudy, like, look at me, more of me in your life, what you need to solve your problems, read me. And everything that you'll find in my work is stop reading me and go hiking, right? Like, go get ice cream with a friend. Go actually listen to an album from start to finish because that's how they used to be made. They're not just singles. Like, whatever it is, go do that. And the books and the work is all an inspiration to try to be okay with yourself. But notice what we are. We are relational. This is part of our being animals, but we're a very particular kind of animal. We are an animal who is not just relationally engaged in a kind of network of competition and, you know, life or death struggle for food. We are the kinds of beings who can actually encourage others of us to beauty, to care, to kindness. And so I actually think if we can find ways to say, look, there's always going to be that segment who thinks any picture I post is me bragging. And I get it. I am a white, heterosexual, full professor of philosophy who is able, I'm physically abled enough to spend a lot of time climbing very steep trails and then riding very ridiculous mountain bikes down them again. I get that that is nested in a history of privilege and social injustice that I want to correct. But when I post those pictures, what I'm actually trying to do is not say, hey, don't you wish you could be like me? What I'm trying to do is say, hey, look, as a philosopher, let me encourage you to think that maybe the sky was pretty amazing tonight, or this leaf is worth your time. So when you post those pictures, Rudy, maybe think about it as an invitation to invite others. Like, it's inviting yourself to invite others to rethink what matters. It's not bragging, right? You're not bragging. It's saying, hey, it matters that we be excited about what excites each other. And I think that's awesome.
Thank you for that. Because I do try to say, hey, here are the mountains that I'm planning to climb this year. Who wants to join me? People have actually reached out and said, hey, yeah, you know, I'd like to try this. I'd like to try that. I always wanted to do this. I always wanted to try that. My whole point of this is, literally, if I can do it, anybody can do it. Now, why do I say that? I was born with deformed feet. I had to wear special shoes when I was a baby for a year and a half. I couldn't take them off to like reform my feet. I have flat feet. I never grew up an athlete or anything. I just made a goal to start climbing mountains and hiking and be becoming a little bit more in tune fitness-wise during the pandemic. And the pandemic really did change my view about what is important. And I guess I'm trying to, I'm not trying to harangue anybody with, this is what you have to do. You have to be out in nature. I'm trying to show these pictures of these beautiful places and saying, hey, look, if I can do it, anybody can do it. So I guess if I can set it up that way, there's always going to be some detract, but in general, that's putting positivity out in the world. Correct, Aaron?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know if you've seen I think it's on Netflix or YouTube or something, or maybe Amazon. I don't know. So many streaming things. But the documentary of Stephen Wampler, it's unreal. So this guy has cerebral palsy and he climbed El Cap, right? Like, I cannot imagine that. He had to do something like 6,000 pull-ups to lift his body all the way up the face of El Capitan. And he did it with friends who helped him make it possible. And I love that this story exists, A, because the dude's a badass, but B, because what it shows is none of us can do this on our own. We are relationally dependent in all the right ways. We all exist and can feed ourselves because somebody used their existence to feed us for the first couple years of our life. That fact is something that then makes me really, really excited about the emails I get from people who, I got an email the other day from somebody out in California, actually. Guy I didn't know, and he said, hey man, I'm 45 years old, just read your book. I wanted to let you know that I was recently divorced, been going through a lot of depression, but I'm taking my two sons camping this weekend, thanks. And I was like, damn it, that's everything that matters, right? Because I don't care that he can quote Kierkegaard back to me. I do care that he thought it was okay to spend time with his sons that weekend and to find a way to get outdoors and do it. And so, yes, there are a lot of people who that is not possible for today. And I think that should call all of us to work for social change such that freedom, flexibility, agency, these are not things only available for those of us with graduate degrees, but are part of how we make sense of human dignity. And so when I post pictures, there is no bragging. What I'm doing is saying, hey, we can think about what is worth our time differently. And so in my presentations I give now at a lot of, you know, business meetings and different big keynote talks and stuff, I always have a picture and a slide with all of my academic books. And the next slide is a picture of me and my son by a campfire. And the idea is to say, look, it's not that we have to pick one or the other, but it is the case that we can start allowing ourselves to realize more is not always better when it comes to trophies, but more might always be better when it comes to investing in the lives of those people who look to us as examples for how to live, whether that be colleagues, friends, kids, or otherwise. We are the ones we have to look at as models for what we want to see in the world.
That's great.
Do you mind if I ask you a difficult question? Put you on the spot.
These meaning of life and ethical questions being the easy ones, right?
No. Actually, those are compared to this question. I really, really believe this. So, having listened to you on other podcasts where you're talking about your son and how your son thought that you lived at the university and how your son said that, Daddy, I don't want to be a philosopher because then you can't spend time with your son. You had this shift during the pandemic. Let me just ask you a very difficult question, Aaron, because I struggle with this as well. Could it be that you were finally able to spend that time with your son, finally able to do the camping because you did achieve a number of certain things in the past and you're able to like, okay, now I can focus on this. And I don't mean to put you on the spot, but it's like, I know you were feeling bad for those things that your son was saying, but you did have some goals that you need to achieve. And I don't think there was anything wrong with those goals. So what do you think about that?
Yeah, no, you're right. This is a harder question in the sense that we don't get to hide behind philosophical nuance. It lays us bare, denuded with ourselves and our choices, right? So yeah, what you're referring to, and for other listeners, is in the book I talk about this. My son, when he was young, would say things like, Daddy, you live at Furman, or he, this one time that lives in infamy in my own memory, told me he didn't want to be a philosopher because they just don't spend enough time with their kids. And he was probably 7 at the time. You'd think I'd have changed stuff, but I didn't. And I think you're right. The reason I didn't change it, it wasn't just because, though, I had goals that I wanted to achieve, and that's okay. It's I genuinely had convinced myself that what love looks like is achieving those things. And that's the stuff that I hope to now invite others to rethink. So I do tell my students, who are again, 18 to 22, 23 years old, I tell them all the time, look, stop trying to be 40 at 21. Go be 21. You can put in different kinds of hours. You have often the just stamina to do things you aren't going to be able to do later. Feel the empowerment to be young. There's a great Edwin McCain song says, go be young. And I think that's exactly right. But I say that not in the kind of, bullshitty Dave Ramsey model of, live like no one else so that you can live like no one else. Definitely not a sponsor. What I'm trying to suggest is there are different times in our life where living faithfully will look different in practical outcomes. So when I was 20, living faithfully was not spending time with my son. I didn't have one. It was being invested in making the most of college, trying to, open the doors to get to grad school, being invested in thinking well about classes and the appropriate balance with my social life. Now, did I do that well? I don't know. I definitely wasn't thinking it through intentionally the way I try to do now. And so it was that I got distracted by what I call the inertia of the everyday. I had gotten so used to spending 80, 90 hours a week at the office that I just decided, well, shoot, this would be easier if I take a cot and leave it at my office and sleep there sometimes. Like I could look how much more productive I could be. And it wasn't, oh, sorry, Vanessa, my wife, like I'm putting my work over you. What I did was actually convince myself, this is what it looks like to love you. And that's where I think I was lying to myself, right? So do I regret the things I achieved? No. I think I wrote some good stuff. I think I was a decent enough professor. I think I probably was good at the things I set out to be good at. Do I regret telling myself why that stuff mattered? Yes. It mattered because excellence matters. It's logistics. And you know what? If I want to have a career as a professor, I'm going to have to front load a lot of time to make that possible. But that front loading time has led to so many of my friends in their 40s, still with pretty mediocre academic positions, not at their fault, but because the field is not a space that cares about us. It abuses those who put in that kind of work, and it takes advantage of it. And so they now find themselves with kids, with families, continuing to say, if only I work hard enough, then I'll get that final job, instead of saying, you know what, it just may not happen. Am I okay with who I am today? And it's kind of like the Jay-Z song where he says, baby, I'm good. Like, I want people to reflect and ask themselves, if you didn't make it to that job, you didn't make it to that promotion, you didn't make it to that, you know, in my case, pandemic that allowed for a resetting of the inertia, are you okay with what you have done and who you have been? And that's where I look back and say, I'm not. Even though what I did, I think was worth doing, I'm not okay with who it made me.
I think that's fair. I think it's interesting, you know, with goal setting and achievement, some people taking different approaches. Some people believe that if you allow doubt to come into your mind about you achieving a goal, the fact that you even ask the question, well, am I okay if I don't achieve that, automatically, you're not going to achieve it.
Yeah, that's what assholes tell themselves to not have to pay attention to their assholery.
You're right. And that's where the balance really, really, really comes in about how to achieve goals. But like, I want to say, not ethically, not like, it's like, there's like a word, and this is, I do feel that this is a huge area of exploration that needs to occur. Yeah. And we touch upon it a bit during Good Is in the Details. It's like how to achieve things, but do it in a way where, you know, you're not an asshole, or you're doing it, you're doing it in a way where the journey is going to make you the person that you're supposed to be if you don't achieve that goal. Yep. But I will say, Aaron, I do think that there's some people out there that if they let any doubt get into their minds, they're not going to be able to achieve anything. I do think that there is something to be said for people who have this laser focus on something. And because they have that, they are able to achieve. I mean, I don't think all of them are assholes. I just don't.
Well, I think the logic is really dangerous. So I am not in this book telling people what they should prioritize. I am simply trying to invite them to rethink the value theory by which they prioritize it. That means to me that if you are willing to say, you know what, all that matters in my life, like think about a professional athlete, right? All that matters is getting to the Olympics. That's going to come at the cost usually of one's childhood. That doesn't make you an asshole. It might make your parents assholes, but that's a separate question. It's instead, are you cognizant, invested, and aware that the choices you are making are choices that you are making? That's my point. You are not an asshole if you're saying, you know what, I've decided to forego family, to forego these relationships because I'm really trying to find the cure for cancer. And I'm going to spend 120 hours a week doing this. And it may come at really high cost, but this is in fact something that matters. Where I would then respond is, awesome. I hope they pull it off, but it won't matter because they did it. It will in fact matter because this is something that will facilitate lives of meaning for all kinds of people. So that they then would do this and think, now I have arrived. That's where I'm trying to say, you won't, because you'll do it. And then you've got a Wednesday next week to still figure out what to do.
Yeah.
That's, right.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how you achieve, you'll still have to be you.
Yeah.
And so my point is, I don't care if someone says, hey, I'm all about money. My response is, cool. That's not the choice that I want to make, but go be about money. Are you being responsible with it? Are you thinking these questions through? I've got a former student who became very, 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 very wealthy and reached out to me at one point. And he said, hey, how much would it cost me to buy you the rest of your life? Which is a great question to have to face, right? And he said, no, he's like, you said that you would want to write and read and fish. How much would it cost to give you the rest of that? I'll put you on as a consultant and we'll just make that happen. And I admit, like, it was tempting. And I turned him down because I said to him, if I accepted, which I think is amazing that you would offer, but if I accepted it, I would never be the voice you need me to be in your life. And he laughed and he said, yeah. He said, you know, it's true. He said, you've never been impressed with what I've accomplished, though you've been excited with me as I've done it. And that's, I think, maybe the way we should live with each other, right? I'm going to fist bump my friend who can make that gnarly jump on the bike and I can't do it. I'm so stoked for him or her to pull that off. But I'm not now, ooh, they are amazing people. It's like, no, they did it a cool bike trick. Awesome, right? Doesn't make them better. The thing that makes us better is actually interestingly grounded in what all the data tells us about quality of life and happiness ratios from the social scientists. It's not the super, super, super developed wealthy spaces where we find this. People live longer and tend to be happier in places where they have real deep connections. They have activities that involve their bodies, and they feel like they have some sense of purpose. Those are the things that I think philosophy has always been inviting us into. My goodness, the Stoics said doing philosophy as a way of life invited us to find inner freedom and peace. So if finding inner freedom and peace is possible while you're spending 100 hours a week trying to start that tech company, God bless you. I have no critique about it. But if you think you'll get the inner peace once you founded the tech company, exited a billionaire, and everybody's cheering you and putting you on TED Talks, now I'm out.
Yeah.
So it's not assholes who do these things. It's doing these things in our culture almost necessarily normalizes the asshole behavior of being entitled and immune from critique.
Yeah.
Because you think your achievement has made your voice now matter more. And that's the thing I think the philosophers always say, like Kendrick Lamar, sit down, be humble.
No, I like that. That's a great way of reframing that, Aaron, and actually really put it into perspective for me, a different way of thinking about it. And I think you're absolutely correct. If you think that your achievements entitles you to some superhero status and that you have this view of yourself that you are better than other people, then that achievement means nothing because you are simply just an asshole.
Amen. That's right. What a great landing place for a podcast episode. Love it, Rudy. Look at that.
Good is in the Details is produced by Dr. Gwendolyn Dolsky and Rudy Sallow. If you have any questions, comments, or want to get in touch, check us out on Facebook, Good is in the Details Pod, and Instagram, Good is in the Details Pod, or you can email us, goodisinthedetailspod@gmail.com. Remember to go to the show notes if you want tickets to the Beverly Hills event, April 5th. Modern Day Wife, meet me at the London, and you can get a discount code. Also, check out Factor. You can get your discount code there in our show notes. And Good is in the Details is also brought to you by AvonmoreInc.com. Planning your next bridge party? Go to AvonmoreInc.com for everything that you need. Tallies, coasters, smart playing cards. Let them know Good is in the Details sent you. Also, check out our show notes to get your copy of Camping with Kierkegaard. Okay, until next time. Bye.